All right, we're ready to begin. We are on session 8 of our course entitled Holy Habitations, and I've decided to use the longest title I could find for our session today, After the Fire, Anglican and Evangelical, quote-unquote, revival churches. And we'll see here in a moment that there are actually two different revivals. It's a little bit of a pun, but nevertheless, this is the title of our session today. It'll be essentially divided somewhat in half, focusing on 17th century and following Anglican churches, and 17th, basically 18th century evangelical churches after the Great Awakening. But first of all, we shall pray. The Lord be with you. Let us pray. Almighty God, our Heavenly Father, who has committed to thy holy church the care and nurture of thy people, enlighten with thy wisdom those who teach and those who learn, that rejoicing in the knowledge of thy truth, they may worship thee and serve thee from generation to generation, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. All right. So, as per usual, we're going to begin with some historical markers. You recall that we just completed our session on the Renaissance and Reformation. And so now we basically have plopped ourselves in the 17th century. Roughly speaking, we'll bring ourselves to that point here with some historical background. And we'll use our English royalty, our monarchy, to help us get there. So if you recall, Henry VIII dies in 1547, but I suppose one of the things he's most famously known for is the Act of Supremacy, which is the considered essentially the separation from Roman authority over England, an act which declares that England, and especially the monarchy, is supreme over the church of that island. Edward VI, which is Henry VIII's son, takes the throne, but he is a hemophiliac. He dies as a young man shortly after he takes the throne. But under his, let's say, watch, the first Book of Common Prayer, which had been worked on for a long time by Thomas Cranmer, is issued in 1549. And not long after, the second Book of Common Prayer in 1552, which is much different than the first, is issued. And that's a whole discussion there, but we're just getting ourselves some context, especially in the English church. Mary Tudor takes the throne after Edward VI. Edward VI is being tutored by Protestants. Mary Tudor is very Roman Catholic. And so under her leadership, she tries to take England back to Rome. Of course, she earns the perhaps unfair name of Bloody Mary for her at least storied ruthlessness about restoring England to Roman authority. But after Mary Tudor passes away not long afterwards, after her taking the throne, Elizabeth I takes the throne, and for a long time, until 1603. And under Elizabeth I, she attempts the Elizabethan settlement between essentially theologically warring elements within England to try and balance this, all of these concerns. It becomes somewhat of a hallmark of Anglicanism to try and balance things rather than go all the way to one side or all the way to the other. Some would say that the Elizabethan settlement has finally failed and you once again have to pick a side, but at least the instinct to try and balance concerns is become something like an Anglican hallmark under Elizabeth I. James 6:1, because he was the, if I got this right, James VI of Scotland, James I of England, same guy, two different numbers. Of course, under him, we receive what many would say is the best English translation of the Bible, the King James Version. King James, not St. James, but King James. That's in 1603. No, when is his? 1611. That's right, 1611. Not long after he takes the throne, after Elizabeth I, he commissions that, and some of the greatest English writers are put to work, such as Lancelot Andrews, in translating to English the Bible. Charles I takes the throne after James, And he takes the Anglican Church in a much more Catholic direction, but not as far as Mary Tudor, who's trying to take us back to Rome. And there is a sort of a, the Caroline Divines. There is sort of a rich period in the history of Anglicanism there in the 17th century where Caroline or men that are serving under King Charles I are writing some brilliant things for the Anglican Church, and some wonderful works are composed during Charles I's reign. Of course, Charles I's reign is interrupted by his beheading at the hand of the Puritan movement. But Charles II is restored in the middle of the 1660, he's restored. And by 1662, we have a new Book of Common Prayer, which once again is something of a balance. You call that the restoration period there, where the monarchy, which had been literally assassinated, is restored in the 1660s. And so we turn now to something that happened in the 1660s that has a lot to do with what we're talking about today, the Great Fire of London in 1666. And in 1666, shortly after the restoration of the Stuart monarchy in Charles II in England, fire broke out in London, taking over 13,000 houses, 92 churches, an untold number of lives. Tremendous fire in London not long after Charles I. Rebuilding began almost immediately, and it proved an opportunity for Anglicans to develop an architectural style, and most importantly, with St. Paul's Cathedral being rebuilt in London as sort of the hallmark of Anglican architecture there in the middle of London, the capital city. In this little medieval etching here, you see the firemen with hooks. So part of the strategy of helping people from burning buildings was pulling the building down. As a building like that with the houses built with mortar and timber, as they were burning, they would put a hook in the window and just pull the whole thing down as it was burning. That's not what we do today, but they didn't have fire trucks. And so you can imagine when a fire like that hits London, it's total wreck and ruin. Here's a painting. I don't know if you can see it very well, but this is the Great Fire of London, painted not even a decade later by an unknown artist. Pretty traumatic event in the history of the church in England. Christopher Wren, 1632-1723. Under the leadership of Christopher Wren, a mathematician and astronomer turned architect, the construction and restoration of some 50 London churches would transform architecture in England and eventually provide the prototype for church construction in Protestant North America, our author of Sacred Power, Sacred Space writes. This is a pretty important figure. Perhaps you've heard the name Christopher Wren before, but you may learn the name of an architect here and there. But seldom is an architect have an opportunity like he has in the 17th century with so many of, I think it was like 90 churches or something like that were burned in London. And they turned to him to say, we need you to design some churches for London, and not a few, a lot. So he says, okay. Anglican churches had been Gothic in style largely, but Wren would turn to a neoclassical style. And you remember that in the 16th century, after the Gothic churches were being sort of replaced with these neoclassical churches with the old Roman arches rather than the Gothic arches, architecture had sort of improved. You remember the gigantic St. Peter's in Rome being a neoclassical style. This is not long afterwards. He says England's going to take on the neoclassical style. And what's the difference between Gothic and neoclassical? Well, there's London. These two churches aren't too far from each other. This is Westminster Abbey, and this is St. Paul's Cathedral under Christopher Wren. Can you see the difference? Yes. Okay. So this looks with the columns and these triangular arches and round arches. We look like we're going back to Rome in a sense here, like ancient Rome. And the Gothic era is somewhat over. We'll point out a little bit later that in all of Christopher Wren's churches, something from the Gothic era remains, which is steeples. Steeples are a part of the Gothic architecture that's developed, and he retains the steeple in almost every one of his churches, and almost every church in North America, you know, at least for a long time, said, you got to have a steeple, otherwise it ain't a church. It's a Taco Bell or something. Until you put a steeple on it, now it's a church. So is this a via media, a middle way that Christopher Wren decides to find here? I think it's true. Wren altered church footprints and interior spaces in a way that carved a compromise between the different views of formalism within worship held by Catholics, Anglicans, and Puritans within the context of political struggle. The Great Fire of London and the subsequent rebuilding of the Christian landscape of the city occurred 20 years after the end of the English Civil War and 6 years after the restoration of Charles II to the throne. In other words, England is in many ways from the 16th, well, all throughout Christian history, England is kind of unique. It's its own sort of story in the Christian church. And just as in the 16th century, Henry VIII declaring the act of supremacy and saying, you know what, Rome, actually the jurisdiction that you took over us is not valid. The Bishop of Rome is the Bishop of Rome, not the Bishop of the entire world. Now, whatever his reasoning for that, he stumbled onto something that is a much more ancient theology, which the East would agree with, that each bishop, each diocese, each nation has something of an autonomy. In the East, they call it autocephaly. You know, a church has its own mind about things. That's an Eastern thought, and sort of by God's providence, the Anglican church, you know, returned to something like that. Well, here in the 16th century, once again, or 17th century, the English church has a chance to do something that no one else is really doing, which is getting out of the gang war. We're going to try to accommodate, or we're going to try to incorporate the best of each of these instincts. There's a Roman Catholic instinct, there is a Puritan instinct, and of course, here we are in England, there is something of our own thought about this as a via media. It is manifested in architecture in the 17th century. Remember Elizabeth, she was not trying to destroy the Romans, and she was not trying to, you know, dominate with a new church in the English Isles. She was trying to basically settle this war within the nation itself. And something of that character of settling things remains in Anglicanism. But here's St. Paul's Cathedral, and you can tell me by that picture, does that remind you of anything? St. Paul's Cathedral, remember last week we were talking about St. Peter's in Rome. There's a striking resemblance to St. Peter's here at St. Paul's in England, or in London. Wren's startling new plan featured a massive dome, a classical feature that would have immediately drawn comparison to St. Peter's in Rome and suggested sympathy with Catholic liturgical formalism. The new St. Paul's, harking back to Rome, but at the same time offering innovative new spaces, satisfied the high church sympathies of both government and the clergy. The building would become a symbol of Anglican formalism for generations to come. It would also function as a symbol of the nation itself. So here in St. Paul's Cathedral in London, we have sort of, we are not discarding our connection to Rome in this church. We're remembering, yes, we are brothers with our fellow Christians in Rome, but we also have those that want to hear the sermon. And so an element of preaching hall is being incorporated. Also, we've begun offering the offices of morning and evening prayer for everyone to hear, not just monks and nuns and priests and bishops and in monasteries. We give an opportunity for all to hear and all to see. So you see these classical style, now would be called neoclassical arches. You see the dome reminiscent, not only of Rome, by the way, but of the Hagia Sophia's dome. A fantastic upward gaze of the people who enter this place. But here at this central area, we're at the center of the cruciform shape of the church. And you see down this front aisle here to the altar, this tremendous series of smaller domes. But along the side, a place for the choir to call and respond the offices, to chant the psalms one to another. Once again, these magnificent arches leading you up to the high altar, which is not blocked by a forest of pillars, but visible. So you see how we're incorporating basically a lot of elements of the church's history, and yet the church's present needs in the construction of this place. You see in the high altar, this is not a diminished altar, or you don't confuse it with a table. This is an altar. Even in these pillars here, there's something reminiscent of Rome. But it's an Anglican manner of finding a middle way between, let's say, warring sides in the broader church. I think it's pretty clever, to be honest, and beautiful and stunning at the same time. But Wren and his plans continue. He does not only design St. Paul's, as I said, but dozens of churches. Here's an example of another one of his churches, St. Lawrence Jewry, named because it was close to a local synagogue in a Jewish neighborhood. Wren was responsible for the design of dozens of London churches after the Great Fire. He was convinced that church building should allow the congregation to both see and hear what was going on in worship. That's as a sort of a development from the Gothic era. His use of space and acoustics accomplished this, and the new emphasis on preaching was also accommodated. And you also see that if you're going to compare this particular church to a Gothic cathedral with screens and small windows, I guess it wouldn't be Gothic, but before that, the darkness of those great stone cathedrals, there is no darkness here. These are giant windows letting in as much light as possible. The room is bright, it's open, the pulpit is elevated, but the altar is not diminished. The altar is diminished as well. You also don't have, a bunch of things blocking your view of the altar. The only thing that blocks your view is the priest himself, which retains some of the mystery of the sacrament communicated through, let's say, the choreography of the liturgy. But it's not that kind of this isn't for you sort of message being communicated by the building itself. In fact, the aisle is wide open. The altar rail is not a screen, and once again, but it's a place for you to come and be fed the sacrament from the Lord via his man, the priest. But you can also hear the sermon, and the acoustics of the room are going to allow you to hear even a soft-spoken minister. Of course, there's no microphone or amplification at the time. The room itself had to amplify. So you've got light, you've got sound, it's open, you're allowed to hear the sermon, you're allowed to see the liturgy, it's in English, so you understand. There's a very Anglican thing. At this time, of course, the Roman church was still conducting the entire service in Latin, which if you were well-educated, you could understand, but if not, you would just pray silently as the Mass continued. So we're developing something of an Anglican distinct architectural style after the fire. Yes, please.
Yeah. Back to that one and St. Paul's.
Yep.
What I notice is there's no statuary or icons
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, of course, icon, you've got imagery in the stained glass.
Not as much as St. Peter's or Catholic churches.
Right. So there's some remembrance of the effort to deface the icons and deface the statuary of less than a century earlier, or maybe about a century earlier. So something of that is remembered in the Anglican Church. And so we don't have a reredos that is full of statuary. There is a glorious reredos there, but perhaps an image of Christ himself alone. So there's something of that middle way being communicated. Janet?
Why is the pulpit on the epistle side?
Yeah, you see that sometimes. The church I came from in Atlanta, St. Barnabas, had the pulpit on the epistle side. And many would say it's the wrong side. They just did it wrong. I don't know. But I don't have a good answer for St. Lawrence Drury why they put the pulpit on the wrong side. But I'm sure somebody had a great reason. Tremendous reason. Here's a famous church, which doesn't look so famous for a reason. St. Martin in the Field, Trafalgar Square, London. Wren's design of St. Martin in the Field became the prototype for church builders operating in the New Republic across the Atlantic, the United States. This is why it doesn't look so unique, because you've seen this a million times here. With its pedimented porch, this is called a pediment, if I'm not mistaken, and supported by six Corinthian columns in the front, and pilasters, that's these sort of Roman style arched windows, I guess you could say, on the side, defining the side and rear facade. St. Martin's is a Christian version of the Parthenon. Does this design look familiar? You ever been to downtown Greenville? That's right, yeah. So now it's called Grace Church, but it used to be what? Used to be First Baptist Greenville, now it's Grace Church. But nevertheless, that looks very familiar, doesn't it? But it's not just Grace Church. It's a million church, well, not a million, but let's say 100,000 churches in this country are designed that way, and they look not unlike the Parthenon, actually. Talk about a neoclassical style. But as we go back, remember, it's a bit of a hodgepodge, because you've got a neoclassical style with a Gothic remnant of the steeple. If you've ever looked at our church, we got the same thing. We got the triangle, two pillars, and a steeple up top. Well, anyway, in this country, that's a church. That's what a church looks like. But you gotta note that there's a little bit of the Parthenon in there. And there's a little bit of Gothic churches there as well. But about that steeple, as a medieval holdover, Wren retained the steeple for each of his churches, feature developed in the Gothic Middle Ages. Crowned with these multi-stage steeples, churches announced their presence in every community in London. And now, the steeple serves the same function in pretty much any little town. The highest thing is the steeple, and it announces, there's the church, which is a good thing. The steepled Parthenon church can be found in countless reiterations in the United States. We're about to change gears here. But there was a new style of church spreading just a little bit after this. So it's kind of interesting to recognize the Parthenon style church was first put together by Christopher Wren, St. Martin in the Field, Trafalgar Square, London. Imitated, never duplicated. But that style is repeated over and over again. And the idea of, what is it? Here's the church. Here's the steeple. Open the doors. Here's all the people. Listen to through the doors, hear them pray. Open the doors, they all run away. Yeah, something like that. Even that little children's rhyme, with the steeple, you can thank the Gothic church and Christopher Wren for the steeple part of that. But what's being developed at the same time, a stroking of the beard, a rubbing of the temples, thinking, I wonder how else we could do this. The round church starts to emerge. The rounded church began to suggest to the congregation that not only should they see and hear the clergyman as he leads them, but they should see each other. The Frauenkirche, I'm going to say, of Dresden was built in the mid-18th century and was a middle ground between formalism and anti-formalism. Inward-facing theater-style seating intentionally blends the roles of observer and participant. So you can see in the development of this church the mentality changing. Now, this would be a Lutheran church, of course, and they retain much of the sacramentalism of the medieval church. And so you have still an elevated altar and reredos and organ now at the front. But the congregation sits in curved pews, and on the sides, they're practically facing each other and not the front. Now, that is not just something put in place because, you know, all they had was a round plot of land or something like that. This is an ideology that's being communicated. We ought to be able to, as a congregation, see one another as we experience God. You know, when you look up in the Frauenkirche, you find once again the great dome hearkening back to not only now St. Paul's, but then St. Peter's, and then any other domed church, including the Hagia Sophia. So you have that sort of element going on. You see, there's a double dome. There's a dome inside the dome in this church. But here's a spooky view. This is from the top, okay? This is from the dome looking down. See how the congregation in the second balcony are basically only facing each other on the sides. The pews at the bottom are curved once again. The pulpit is right here. It's almost like he's at the helm of a ship or something like that. And as priest, which the baptismal is behind him and the altar is behind that, but the priest sort of, when he goes to the altar, he recesses somewhat into a place that's harder to see. But at the pulpit, the sermon is the big thing, right? Baptismal font, I think, was around here, and then the altar is in the back. But that sort of mentality is, you know, the architecture itself is revealing a change in the manner in which we corporately encounter God and worship. But there's something else. Not only the fire of London, but a revival fire that changes architecture, especially in North America, in the following years. Wesley, Whitfield, Finney are preaching, and they're preaching outside originally because, like for Wesley, he was not trying to establish a new church, but he did want to be able to have a place to preach where you could accommodate enormous crowds, and everyone would feel a part of what's going on. So they had revival tent meetings and camp meetings outside. So this fire would also produce developments in architecture. With the advent of the Great Awakening in the United States especially, space was deemed necessary to accommodate a new religious experience. And you can gather that this was where we weren't looking for a long and an erudite liturgy. We were looking now for an experience that we could have ourselves. So centralized spaces, curved pews, amphitheater style seating encouraged church members to see and hear not only the sermon but each other's religious experience of revival. So we weren't just looking at each other now. We want to see each other's response to this sermon, because sometimes people will faint, will pass out, will burst into holy laughter, will, you know, some experience is going to happen here, and we want to see it. So we sit in such a way that sort of imitates the great camp meetings, and architecture starts to accommodate for that. In New York, the Broadway Tabernacle was constructed around 1850, and it's constructed, of course, in the round. You notice now the altar is gone. There's no altar anymore. We're not here to celebrate the Eucharist. We're here to hear the sermon, but we're here not just to hear the sermon. We're here to witness a happening. Something's going to happen here today. And you see once again the dome. The dome, you can't get away from the dome. Revival and camp meetings made visible the centrality of the social or communal component of evangelical worship. Evangelical worship was about sharing that experience with others and watching how others experience the divine. Longitudinally oriented rectangular worship spaces hindered the ability of congregants to participate in the communal nature of evangelical worship. You will find that in the Anglican Church's resistance to a round church, you'll find something of the English reserve. If I perhaps cry during this service, I don't want everybody staring at me and everybody saying, oh, look, you know, so-and-so is having an experience. You want your own pew reserved. I actually don't necessarily want someone to stand up in the middle of the service and interrupt everything and start speaking in tongues or saying something or taking over the service or falling out in the aisle. It's not really an English thing. So, let alone, if it were to happen, it wouldn't be the end of the world. But we don't design the architecture of the church to see each other. But that's kind of what was going on, you can see, in the architecture here in the 19th century. In Minneapolis, Westminster Presbyterian Church was built in 1898, and it reflects much of the same mentality of the circular church where we can see each other and our experience. Notice the enormous hulking organ, which is behind the clergy, the preacher, and I guess a choir might sit here. But all of these things are meant to focus you. But you were not simply an observer. You were a participant in the entirety of the service. Perhaps if you've been to an evangelical church, I remember when I was at Tocoa Falls College, we would all begin a service seated. And then during the worship music, someone would stand, probably someone at the front, would stand. And that meant that they were having an experience. And then someone else would stand. And then, you know, 10 people would stand. And then 30 people would stand. And then 100 people would stand. And then we'd all stand. And we thought that was really important. And I can't for the life of me think of what's important about that now. But nevertheless, it was something like we weren't just observing. We were participating. And something of the movement of what was going on in this room was visible in what we were doing. The altar call, especially, to come down to, as I read, it was called the anxious seat. There was a bench, the anxious bench up front. That was the altar call. And what a great deal it was to stand up from your pew and walk down to the front for the altar call. Now, we are not opposed to altar calls. We got altar calls all over the place. But everybody comes for the altar call. Here, it was much more in this sort of religious, let's say, experience or mentality or even architecture, standing up in your seat, moving out to the aisle and coming forward was a dramatic moment, and often associated with much tears and prayers and stopping the service or telling the band to keep playing, you know, that kind of thing. We don't have any spot like that in our liturgy, and there's a reason. I'm not opposed to it, and the Anglican Church is not opposed to it, but you can see in the architecture, which kinds of things we're accommodating for. Here's Bob Jones University Chapel. Now, this is a university, but it's nevertheless a chapel, right? And how did they build? Oh, that's, you can't really see it very well. But if you've ever been in the Bob Jones University Chapel, you see, of course, it's all circular. And there's several different aisles. They all focus on the man in the pulpit, the author here who writes about power, not just sacred space, but sacred power, had an interesting comment about this, about the communal nature of the congregation and the preacher. Not only does the people in the round communicate that we're all here to participate in this, but it suggests also that if he were to do something wrong, we could converge on him at once. I had never thought of that before. He's got nowhere to run and nowhere to hide because he's down in the bottom. We will coalesce upon him as soon as possible. So if you're going to speak the word, you better do it right. Anyhow, those circular churches have a number of let's say, effects. But they're not designed that way purposelessly. There's a reason there. There's actually a history to it. And something of that theater-type seating allowed people to basically decide for themselves how they wanted to respond. You weren't going to come forward for communion because we weren't offering that today. But you could come forward. Now it's your choice. You don't have to have an experience, but if you do, you're going to be seen. And maybe that's a good thing. Maybe you want that. I don't know. But in reaction to all this, now we're getting to our own time here in the 19th century. What's next? We've got two more sessions after this one, but we're going to talk about modern architecture next. But here we are in the late 19th century. We have a church like this being built, St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York, 1858. What does that look like? This is Gothic. We've decided not to go forward. We've decided not to go back a little bit to neoclassical. We're not doing anything. We're going back to medieval Gothic. So this you would call neo-Gothic. It's the new Gothic. But you could easily mistake that church as one built in the 13th century in Paris or something like that. And that's the idea. In the face of radically new designs and changing times, the draw of many was to return to older style structures. Not only neoclassical, but neo-Gothic style churches began to emerge. And as a response to this, even wilder designs emerged across many Western denominations, including Roman Catholicism. So there was a return for some to the ancient, and for others, a rejection of the return to the ancient, and a moving forward into wild new ideas that had nothing to do with the past. So this is Ronchamp, France, built in 1954, Notre-Dame du Haut, which is called the first postmodern church to be built. In other words, well, postmodernism is too hard to explain, but the idea is there is something, let's say, nonsensical about, intentionally nonsensical about the construction of this place. So there's the exterior of this church. The interior from the side looks like this. So there are some pews, but not a central aisle and pews on both sides, because that's too derivative of an older style. We're doing something wild and new and unrelated, and almost like many ideas of the past and present are put into a blender, and you push puree and you come out with this. So there's a philosophical discussion behind this. You still have an altar, you still have an altar rail, you still have pews for the congregation, but you have what looks like sort of a haphazardness to the construction. Very much the opposite of a Gothic church, Gothic cathedral, even a neoclassical church. This is not the Hagia Sophia. This is not one of these famous churches in Paris, but just up the road, this is the new style, 1954. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that next week. And this was a bit of a history lesson on the, you know, typical Anglican ethos, and then the manner in which evangelicalism was starting to develop their own architectural style. But as reactions to both of these go both ways, you see what I will say is most of the architecture that you see these days are drawing something from the past, something from the past. The only type of architecture that's simply trying to create something new is this kind of thing. But most people, when they react to a building like this, go, ugh. I'll say one of the coolest things that was ever said to be about a person who was being introduced to Anglicanism and essentially historical theology and Catholic theology was a person who said to me, it's almost like as I'm learning this, I'm remembering something. Ooh, that's good. I'm remembering something that we as Christians knew for centuries beforehand. It's not just theology, but something in the architecture. You walk in a room and it's like, what is it about this place? You remember when we talked about the Hagia Sophia? You walk in there and you say, what is it about this? It's like I remember this. Or like there's something being communicated here about something my heart knows. That's what's, I think, disconcerting disconcerting about a church like this. As you look at it and you say, if I know this, it's from the disorder of my life. And that's the part I'm trying to put down. I'm trying to have my life basically organized like a Gothic cathedral where I know where I'm going and it's beautiful every step of the way. Not, it's confusing and I don't get it. So anyway, we'll continue, not next week, but the week afterwards. We have morning prayer next week, but we do have a little bit more time than usual for questions today. First of all, Father Steve.
Looking at the picture there, it's like an outside altar and a pulpit as well.
Right, yeah, it looks like an outside altar and a pulpit at Notre Dame du Hop. Some churches do have, an outdoor altar. They use it for something like Easter morning for a sunrise service or something like that, which is okay. We recall as we go back to the earliest of our classes here that worshiping outdoors was associated with paganism in the 4th century, and so most of the church didn't want to celebrate outdoors, but, you know, it's the Lord's earth too. And I think we had one more back here, and then to you, Pat.
How would you define the church, the cathedral of abandoned Barcelona?
Cathedral, that would be neo-Gothic. I would say you're asking about the Cathedral of the Holy Family in Barcelona, which is a centuries-long project. But my recollection of it would be a neo-Gothic. In other words, we're not in the 13th century, but we're recreating it. Unless there's some element of it that I'm missing, that's what I would call it. But Pat had a question.
Yeah, the one you're missing is it's Muslim, too. It's got some Eastern.
Oh, okay.
It's a spiral, and it looks a little bit more like Arabic.
Oh, okay, so there's some Arabic elements. I've never been there, and I only recall the enormous spires and the complicated Gothic arches, so that to me says Gothic. But Pat had a question.
Yeah, and all of the parallel between the two Charles.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, might have the influence on the structure. The churches we went to in Ireland, they were more like a castle.
Okay.
With the...
It depends on when they were built.
Because
if it's early Middle Ages, the castle was because there's invaders. But if it was built in the 17th century like a castle, then it was kind of like a battlement.
Instead of just one steeple, it had the
two. Two on the side.
Like
bell towers. Yeah.
Even inside, the pews, we were in stalls in one.
Right, yep.
Where you sit, as a family, you close the door each morning.
Yeah, the pew stalls was another innovation sometimes used to separate the higher class from the lower class. So if you were a higher class, you had your own pew stall with a door with your name on it, that kind of thing. Like you'd pay for it and everything. But I don't know that it was for security.
Why, because they're like benches in a square, except for where the door is, and you're all looking
at each other. Okay, well, I'd have to look at that particular church, but. We had
to preserve the heat.
Preserve the heat, that's right. So,
bring hot stones and things.
Right. I left out a quote a couple Sundays ago because I thought it might be too funny. But it said as pews were being developed and as pews were used along with balconies to establish class, that certain people would reserve their pews and insist on sitting in that same pew and sometimes leave things like cushions and bags and all that in their spot to reserve their spot and foot warmers. They would leave the foot warmer there so you knew that was the Rivard pew. You don't sit in the Rivard pew. you know, and later that would be replaced with plaques. Like they would literally have a plaque on the pew. And as I understand it, there are some churches in Greenville where the plaque on the pew remains, and you don't sit in that spot. But anyway, I don't know if we're getting askew. I always end too late, so I'm going to end now. Sorry, Brian, you had a question?
Just real quick, did you know in Westminster and St. Paul's, do people walk from the choir to receive communion, or do they come out?
The question is, do people get up from their pews and walk through the choir to receive at the altar? I hope they do. I've never been there for a service, but I would assume that the clergy don't come out through the choir. You walk through the choir to the altar rail. And they have those aisles down the side. Maybe someone knows, but you know, when I was showing you the inside of St. Paul's and those magnificent arches, the arches also are, there's ambulatories on the side. So you could probably go forward through the choir, back through the ambulatory to your pew.
Yeah. As
I understand it, the choir, the question is, when did the choir move from the back to the front? As I understand it, was an Anglican move to put the choir up front. And so I don't know when that happened, but for most churches before, the choir would be in the loft behind. And, you know, when we're talking about modern constructions, they're all derivative of another era, so it's hard to say. And that's where we got to stop for today. And we'll see you in a minute.